Well, welcome back. Is anybody new? Some new people found their way here. We are, I'm going to get all tangled up here. For those of you that are new and those of you that are returning, would you mind if I catch everybody up a little bit? Just a real quick recap. And I know that's a bit of a repeat, but I almost all be on the same page, but I'll go really fast. For the new people, we were talking about summer and winter Christians this morning. And this came out of a variety of different places. But the basic idea that I shared this morning is that even though we are all people of faith, the experience of faith can be very different. And so there's a lot of theological diversity in our congregations. The idea is for pastoral work to be done well and sensitively, some education on our part is needed to kind of understand who we're talking to, so that as we rub up against each other in the communities of faith, as we're in crisis, that kind of the counsel that we give, the classes we offer, the worship we offer, recognizes that diversity and doesn't alienate people. And as I said this morning, I couldn't have gotten a better introduction to what we were talking about than Randy's final point this morning, where he said, you know, is there a place where people could say even potentially heretical things and they're going to be accepted and cared for, or do they take it underground? And really what we were talking about is, first of all, give us a vocabulary to understand those people. And so we call them this, you know, we call these people who say these crazy things winter Christians. And I confess that I was one, and some of you have confessed afterwards, and that's good for the soul. But some of you are summer Christians, and but mostly we mostly move through life in different seasons anyway. There are periods of summer and winter, fall and spring, as we move through our faith journey. So we all can resonate with all of these things, I'm sure. And then I contrasted that with another style called the summer Christian. Just labeling, I don't know if you've ever done that. You ever taken a little psychological inventory and kind of get a little label back, and, you know, so somebody starts walking around and says, I'm a golden retriever. And you're like, what are you talking about? Well, it means I'm organized and disciplined, and you're this, you're a poodle, or whatever. There is something normalizing and helpful about just getting this taxonomy. And like I said, my experience at Highland, after I shared this language, it's a pretty much a common language now in the church. And it helps people kind of say, you know, you're coming from this perspective, I'm coming from this perspective, and that's great, and we're going to share those stories. And so even this has some pastoral value, just even the taxonomy. But I want to give a little bit more this afternoon about the way we might do church differently. But to make this clear, very quickly, we talked about how the summer Christian struggle is often with self, with sin, with Satan, the three S's I just realized. The winter Christian is going to more directly take their struggle with God, that God is the thing that preoccupies them as far as what they wrestle with, what they struggle with. God's presence, God's reliability. And we talked about in the Lament Psalms about how God Himself is not an enemy. It's God directly that's taken to them. But the faith experience, these are just a couple things I talked about this morning. The faith experience of the summer Christian tends to be more one of conviction. The winter Christian is one more of hope. They don't know much. I tell my students, you know, all the time. They say, you know, what's your take on you know, X. And I go, well, there's about five different ways you can look at that. You know, this way, this way, this way. What's the right way? I don't know. You know, well, what's your take on Y? Well, there's about five different ways you can look at that. You know, and you stay pretty much in a state, I'm not sure. And so doubt is a more present facet of this faith walk, but we remain hopeful. I believe, you know, if you think about the gifts of the Spirit, you know, Paul says there is a gift of faith. Now think about that, a gift of faith. There are some people who just, That is their gift. They are just, they believe, and they believe to the core, and as a gift they offer to the community of faith. I think my father has this, you know. I'm a winter Christian, my dad's kind of a summer Christian, and he finds me completely incomprehensible. And I used to think my father just wasn't, you know, he wasn't getting it. You know, I was trying to always convert him to my kind of perspective. But the more and more I watch what he did, he's an elder in the church in Pennsylvania where I grew up, and still serving there, I began to believe that that was a gift that he was giving. This is kind of rock solid, and that's the way people refer to him in that church. It's kind of a rock. And there are people like that who have that gift of faith. I think people with the gift of faith are like the skeletal structure of the church. You know, they're the timbers and the beams, and because you build a church on me, and people be, you know, all confused, you know, and so somebody has to bring that conviction. We also talked about maybe even how we view the Bible. The summer Christian is going to see it as a source of answers. The winter Christian is just going to stir up more questions. So rather than the Bible easing our wounds, we become perplexed by it. I talked about how we want to co-mingle these stories that both bring a viable perspective, and that the winter Christian makes the praise of the summer Christian more gritty, more realistic, more in contact with the suffering of the world. That makes your church more missional, okay? That it is in contact with the nitty-gritty of life. And so the winter Christian helps with that. And the summer Christian supports the winter Christian through seasons of doubt and witnesses to the hand of God, even when we might cry out, my God, you know, why have you forsaken me? What we did was we then looked to try to figure out a way we can connect speech about our experience with that experience. And we went through Walter Brueggemann's taxonomy of Psalms of Orientation and Psalms. Good example, if you were not here this morning, is Psalm 1. And then Psalms of Disorientation. And a good example here is Psalm 13. And for a really dark psalm, we ended with, unfortunately, Psalm 88 for a dark night of the soul. And that how both psalms are present, and they train us in ways we can approach God, and God is able to listen to that. And clearly God wants us to take that to him. So that's kind of what I laid out. The other thing, one more piece to this is that to help avoid confusion and help you kind of pastorally diagnose who you're dealing with in this summer-winter taxonomy, one of the other heuristics I laid down was that we might think that you either have faith or you don't, right? And so if you're doubt, you know, so faith and doubt, you know, you move back and forth between these kinds of things. It's an either or. But what we found in our research at ACU, and this will be the last review thing I say, if you stick with me here, was that we found that spiritual life isn't just bipolar. It's not just simply, if you struggle or wrestle with God or have doubts, then you lack faith. It's a different kind of faith experience. If I could summarize it, say it again, the winter Christian experience is a different kind of faith experience. And it's not just a lack of faith. Because we found in our research that basically people will describe what it feels like to be in a relationship with God across two dimensions. Communion, which is being close to God, committed to God, sensing God's presence in your life. That's a dimension. But there's also another dimension that is at right angles with it that we've called complaint, where we find our God perplexing or absent or not as reliable. And so the summer Christian would be over here, where there is high communion, a lot of faith and commitment, but very little complaint. It's the peaceable settlement of faith issues that we talked about. The winter Christian experience is where there is still this high communion, but there's also complaint. There are still some issues that are wrestled with and ever present. Now, this it needs to be opposed to this quadrant, which I call just a critic. Somebody who is low on communion. They're disengaged from God. They're not really even seeking God. They're not really a full partner in the faith journey with your church. And that's behaviorally diagnosed in a lot of different ways, to the degree to which they're kind of, you know, in your ministries and involved with what you're doing. But every time you sit down with them and talk about their faith walk and walking, aren't you more committed? You just get a lot of critique. You know, go, you know, what about this and what about that? And the Bible's inconsistent. And what about the problem of evil? And that's different than this person. This person is doing everything and as much as the summer Christian. But there's just this added addition of complaint. And then this person, I never did label this quadrant, did I? Disengaged. Or apathetic, you could say. There's no connection, nor is there much complaint. There is, some people might call this a nominal Christian. In name only, you go to church and there's very little spiritual depth there. Okay, clearly these two people are not on the journey. This one doesn't care because of apathy. This one is just a critic. And the thing I was trying to share this morning is we talked about a young man who visited my class at Sojourners, at the Sojourners class at Highland, who heard us kind of air some complaint in class and found that really liberating to hear people further down the path going, you know, I thought I was the only one that wondered that. And I see students like this all the time at ACU sit across me and go, you know, I'm confused about these kinds of things. And it's because they have a place of airing that we can take that complaint and move them into this quadrant, keeping them engaged with the church, engaged with people's spiritual wisdom, and bond them. They might stay winter for the rest of their life, but they're in the journey. If we make those young people go underground, or you make that new Christian, if their complaint grows and they don't really have a place for it, they'll just start getting disengaged and just become a critic. And then they might be one of these people that are just, you know, I'm tired of organized religion because it's all just not realistic, it's fake, it's Pollyanna, it's goody two-shoes, everything's, you know, great and wonderful, but it's not, and so they're not in contact with reality. And that's kind of the trajectory that those people get on. Yes?
Do you have on your research any percentage of who populates those quadrants?
No, and the reason why is, and by the way, we'll pause right here because that's kind of the quick, real fast summary. So if you're confused, let's ask some questions or get some feedback. But no, we don't, because we don't have a sense yet. The data set isn't big enough to get a sense of kind of what the, you know, what the mean is. I mean, at what point do you make a, do you cut it off and say, well, now you're winter? Because it's a bit of a continuum. And so when we talk, not to bore y'all, but, you know, I'm talking right here about a typology. And often people don't have pure types, you know. There's more of a continuum, and I kind of joked this morning that I'm really not wintry anymore, but more kind of a fall Christian, and my wife's now more of a spring-like Christian. Some comments after class were about, you know, is this personality-driven? Is it event-driven? And the answer is probably both. Some of us is dispositionally kind of a baseline of where we kind of, and then we move from there up and down. I've seen people radically transformed, where, you know, a loss, a tragedy kind of moves somebody fundamentally in one corner. They see that tragedy through that, you know, that the Bible through that lens, and they change. So I think we can change. I think we can grow, move back and forth depending on life. And so I think it's a little both, dispositional and situational. There was another hand that didn't, you know. No? Are there any questions or comments or clarifications for anybody that was new or some thoughts you had over lunch?
Well, I'm not new, but I just... You haven't made me think for so long.
Hey, that's good.
So, I'm struggling a little bit, I guess, because as an elder, you get people who life has just really, everything that can go wrong has and continues to do so, and they question you know, what God's trying to tell them, or God cares, or where are the benefits of this? Because I need something in this life right now. Throw me a bone.
Yeah.
And so I associate them as an event that's driven them sort of in that upper right hand.
Right. Uh-huh.
And my desire seems to be to pull. I want them back in the upper left hand quadrant. And that's my struggle, is how to get there. You talked about, for some reasons, I don't maybe as clearly identify with that you are just kind of that way, and your wife pulled you back toward.
Right.
But I'm hearing a lot of stuff, a validation of you need upper right-hand quadrant people. And that's the part that, you know, I know that I need to be sympathetic to them, empathetic, know where they're coming from, feel their pain, you know,
right,
to help them. But I'm struggling between that and this validation that people in the upper right-hand quadrant are necessary, a necessary part of the population. Can you kind of help me? Not that I've eliminated them.
Yeah.
I don't want them in the upper right-hand.
No. I mean, I think there's a, I mean, there's a bunch of things that you said that I can, you know, respond to. We could bracket necessary and say whether it's necessary or not, they're going to be there. I then happen to also believe that they bring something to the table, and because of where I am, you're probably getting the hard sell on the value of the winter Christian. Mostly, it's just because. I think that's the part, that's the speech and experience that tend to be de-emphasized. So I am trying to normalize it, say it exists, let's give it a space. How do we give it a space? Well, one of the things we could do is kind of come up with a little vocabulary that allows people to kind of say, you know, so now in my classes people say, well, I'm kind of a winter Christian. So that means I'm now, what that does is that puts everybody at ease to say, okay, they're going to say something that has high complaint in it. You know, that's going to kind of have a struggle or a question, or Randy used the word heresy. You know what I mean? When they kind of preface that, say, you know, I'm kind of a winter Christian, and you get a reputation for that. So they know, and that helps everybody in the class calm down, because we know what's coming, and we're not surprised, and otherwise it just comes out of the blue, and there's no structure for it. It just seems, you know, nobody's kind of asked that kind of question before. And when it's prefaced with this language, then people can relax. It's more normal. And I do think those questions, whether or not they are necessary, they exist, and they need to be processed and then folded into the faith. Whether or not somebody in tragedy, you want to try to move them, you know, to some place, my argument would be is that you want to move them higher on the communion dimension rather than kind of reduce complaint. That is to say, you want to bond them to the community of faith and therefore God. And so what you're doing is not so much trying to, you go with me on this? You're not trying to answer their complaints. You feel free. By the way, if you would like to if you like to try to give an answer for why suffering and death occur, have at it. But what I'm saying is, I'm not so we need to step in and say, let's shut down that complaint, as much as we start working on this dimension here, and we start moving alongside them, and we listen to their speech, and say it's okay to feel that way, and you might be angry at God for a long time, but here's the thing, you're going to be angry at God with me here, and in this community of faith, and there's nothing about the grittiness of reality that's going to freak any of us out. We're going to move alongside you. And maybe you sit there and read a lament psalm and say, how long, O Lord? That's it. You know, and that lets them know that in this emotional time, in this wounded time, I'm not a pariah if I'm angry. Does that make sense? So I don't know if you want to move them so much from quadrant to quadrant, but at the very least you want to move them up the dimension. I will kind of talk about that. We're going to move into Psalm 73, where I think there's a very good model of how to do this. Not right now, but we're going to head there about kind of the way that Psalm works through those issues. Other questions or comments at this point? Okay, I want to keep track of our time.
I guess the thinking and deepening as you move as you move toward greater communion, it's actually moving towards the summer quadrant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as you go up that scale, the scale tips
yeah.
toward the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But it tips toward the other side because it's going to greater communion, either with family. With the
mm-hmm.
family or with God.
Yeah. And these dimensions are probably not, you know, that you're right, that there is a correlation though, as communion goes up and up, that complaint should attenuate and weaken somewhat, and yeah. It is interesting to think about how this all plays out over time. You know, if you think about your own faith walk and somebody had a question. What's your name again?
Bill.
Bill's talking to me about kind of providence and the will of God and, you know, how these different people approach this. And, you know, my quick off-the-cuff response was, you know, my sense in students, and this might be not summer Christian, but might be students, because they're pretty young in their faith walk. But I got some students who had this pretty optimistic take on things. When you ask them about God's will, their answer is, you know, it's discernible. First of all, it's there, and it's discernible. And I am in my calling is to seek it and find it. There's a cost for that. My students are crippled by making a mistake. You know, is this what God wants me to do or not? Because if I get it wrong, then you know, I've missed it. The golden thread that lines my life, I'm off the thread now. And so they are sniffing that out. So there's a cost to that kind of vision. But the metaphor I said, they tend to be kind of front window kind of people. The will of God is out there, and it's the road, and I'm going to follow that road. My sense is that winter Christian people approach providence questions a little differently. First of all, again, because of their fuzzy nature, are going to be much more willing to even ask if God has a will. He does have a will, but whether or not I should go do A, B, or C, their answer is going to tend to be, well, any of the above would be fine. So that makes it more difficult, right? Now I don't even know if there is a specific will to discern here, other than the ultimate will to be conformed in the image of His Son. But whether that should be done in the mission field or getting a job in Dallas, or you know, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. And they tend to discern it not on the front end, but tend in the rear view mirror. And so I gave the example of Joseph. If you ask Joseph while he was thrown into the pit by his brothers and sold, you know, as a slave. You know, is that God's will for you? Joseph would probably go, doesn't feel like it right now. I mean, but he goes through his whole life, and it's only when the famine hits and the family, you know, that so here God has positioned him so that when this famine breaks out, God can keep His promise to Abraham and not let the Israelite nation starve. And so they come to Egypt for grain, and it's only at this point that Joseph goes, now I get it. In the rearview mirror, I can see it. But all during that time, this will of God thing was very opaque and very, I don't know, you know. But it's a rearview mirror kind of thing. So I've been thinking issues like that, you're going to have people in your classes or in your congregation, you say, what do you think about the will of God? And you're going to have different answers from all these different people. And can we listen to all those different answers? Do I have a half hour right now? Is that right? Okay, let me hustle. All right. So one of the things I said, I'd try to give you some ideas about how we might do this at church, how we might incorporate all the forms of experience to give everybody a home. So let me talk. Let me first talk about normalizing. Where's the little book I had up here? Oh, normalizing that winter experience. Obviously, by even just giving it a name and using that name in your classrooms or even in your, you know, your pastoral counseling, that's a way of normalizing it. But I want to read you something my wife was reading to me the other day. I said, that's a great idea. It's very interesting. There's this book out here called Velvet Elvis. Has anybody seen this book? Anybody? Yeah, it doesn't sound like a spirituality book, but it is. Published by Zondervan in And in this book, forget the author's name again, Rob Bell, who's in ministry, has this section entitled Questions. Okay? I don't know if you have anybody that would be so daring to do this, at church, but it's an idea, and it's kind of very similar to what we did in our class at Highland. A Christian doesn't avoid questions. A Christian embraces them. In fact, to truly pursue the living God, we have to see the need for questions. Questions are not scary. What is scary is when people don't have any questions. What is tragic is faith that has no room for them. We sponsored a doubt night at our church a while back. People were encouraged to write down whatever question or doubts they had about God and Jesus and the Bible and faith and church. We had to get a large box to hold all the scraps of paper. Now, let's pause there for a second. Would your box fill up at your church? And that's the question, right? Maybe we have no idea, and that's maybe the big point I make about all this, is that all of that is right now underground. Is there a way of normalizing it? The first question was from a woman who had been raped and didn't press charges because she was told that doing so wasn't, quote, the Christian thing to do. The man then raped several other girls, and this woman wanted to know if God would still forgive her even if she hadn't forgiven the man who raped her. Did I mention that this was the first question? And here are a few more asked later on that night. Why does God let people die and so young? Why does it seem that mean people get most of the money? Why does the killer go free and the honest man die of cancer? Sometimes I doubt God's presence in starving Africa. If we ask God for forgiveness at our very last breath, why strive for a godly life in the present? Either God is in control or everything is so... Either in God's control of everything, and so all the crap we see today is a part of His plan, which I don't want to accept, or it's all out of control, which sucks too, so what's up? Probably written by a teenager. So what's up? This is just a random sampling. I have page after page of questions on my desk. Heaven and hell, suicide and the devil, God and love and rape, and some are very personal, some angry, some desperate, some very deep and philosophical. Most of my responses, and here's kind of coming at this communion idea, most of my responses were about how we need others to carry our burdens, and how our real needs in life are not for more information, but for love and community. So again, we're not addressing the complaint as much as we're trying to move them into community with other people on the journey. But what was so powerful for those I spoke with was that they were free to voice their deepest fears, hearts, and minds. Questions, doubts, struggles. It wasn't the information that helped them. It was simply being in an environment to which they were free to voice what was inside. You got anybody in your church that's bottled up like that, that needs somewhere, but they don't know. They don't know what the elders will think, or the preacher's going to think, or the Sunday school teacher's going to think. You know what? Because church talk is so cleaned up. And this is why questions are so central to faith. A question by its very nature acknowledges that the person asking the question does not have all the answers. And because the person does not have all the answers, they are looking outside of themselves for guidance. It's a good point about that. Questions, no matter how shocking or blasphemous or arrogant or ignorant or raw, are rooted in humility. A humility that understands that I am not God and there is much more to know. So first idea, normalize the winter Christian complaint. You can do that by using the labels, things like a doubt night, a class just devoted to doubt, a sermon devoted to doubt is a big part of that. And my sense is confession is a big piece of that. That people see their minister struggle and their leader struggle and say, I've been there, but I stay connected with community. How about classroom education? My wife, is anybody from Southern Hills here in Abilene? Yeah, I know there's some people from Southern Hills, yeah. Do you know the Marcellanes? I'm going to tell their story a little bit. Rob and Tammy Marcellane are friends of ours from ACU, but they're members at Southern Hills, and they're good friends of our family, and they're one of their youngest sons, he's a twin named Jack Marcellane. has a brain tumor, and they had it removed, but now it grew back, and they're going through chemo. And if you want to follow the Marceline story, which is an amazing witness to faith, you can type in Jack Marceline blogspot, and there the Marceline family is working through, and there's pictures of Jack at various different stages of this. And I share their story for two reasons. One is that Tammy is a very summer Christian kind of person in many ways. The Psalms of Orientation really speak to Tammy, and which is interesting because it might seem the way I've set this up that summer Christian is, you know, not as sophisticated, not as deep. Some people get that impression when I do this. And that winter Christians, you know, they're wrestling, they're struggling, and because of that, they're kind of, you know, deeper or whatever. But Tammy's a good witness to that when she's in conversation with my wife, Jana, they're really good friends. You know, Jana, you know, I'm more prone to turn to the lament psalms, you know, if I was going through a very similar experience. But Tammy likes to turn to those orientational psalms, the psalms that has God is exalted and high and everything's in control and everything's orderly. And it's not a naive running from the reality, clearly. But it is a kind of a reassurance in many ways that it is in control. So that even in suffering, those songs of praise can be sung. What is critical about the difference between that and what I said this morning is that Tammy's finding those for herself. So that is not imposed upon her, okay? Like I said, when people are in grief, you don't want to make that move unless they're willing to do that first with you. But those Psalms of Orientation are profound. Some of us, one of the interesting distinctions between the summer and winter, some of us really get mired in the local, right? You look around the kind of the mud pool of your life, and that's about the bounds of your vision, you know. And that's where the song of lament. You can kind of just see, as a metaphor, Job just sitting down with the boils and scraping himself off of the potsherd, just sitting there. That's it, the local situation. And sometimes these songs of orientation, if you notice, what the summer Christian is really doing is the way they get through it is they take a global perspective. I don't know if you've noticed this, but that's the perspective they typically take, the God's eye view of how it's all going to work out in the end. And that is reassuring. And so it's not a difference of sophistication or depth. Usually it's often a tension between the local experience of the person's going through, people who kind of focus on that, and people who look at the big picture. So this person is going to say all the suffering in the world right now. This person is going to make a much global perspective, but God will do what? All things will work together, you know, for those. So they have that. So oftentimes this is just a difference of perspective. And there's a truth in each. So there's a time when the local needs the position of the global, the God's eye view, what's really going on. And there are times when the global people, those of you that like that global perspective, that take solace in it, have to hear the pain of the local story. And don't want to too quickly run them up the mountain and say, here's the way it looks. Your child is in a better place, even though they passed away. You know what I mean? That's true from that perspective, but it hurts when they are here. And so oftentimes, I'm just talking about switching those perspectives in a timely manner. But here's some, you're like, how am I making a point about classrooms? My wife was beginning to teach, and she is teaching right now, ladies' class at Highland on the book of Matthew. And as she sat down, she said to this, in my relationship with Tammy and her struggles with her son having cancer, everything I say in this class, I'm going to put through. This is what my wife said to me. I'm going to filter it through the Tammy Marceline filter. Do you see what she's trying to do? Everything I'm going to say in this Sunday school class, or anything you're going to say in prayer or in a sermon, I'm going to filter it through that experience. I'm not going to be too quick to recognize that somebody out there is in deep pain. I'm going to filter it through so I'm always, you know, playing off of that. And in many ways, one of the ways I like to think about this, to put it visually, is that we have this orientational, the summer, and then the disorientation. Is that they're always in dialogue with each other, okay? That the world is okay and it's well-structured. God is reliable. He will keep His promises to you. But then the voice of disorientation says what? But it doesn't quite seem that way now. It doesn't seem like the righteous are prospering. But God will draw all things together and back and forth. These are critiquing each other back and forth, back and forth. And so the question is, which is right? And the deep answer, I think, is that neither one is, because each one wants a formula that'll settle the issue rather than keep the dialogue moving along. And many theologians suggest that this is the very point. That what keeps God as the transcendent in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, the transcendent Holy One of Israel, is that no speech will capture Him. No matter what you say to me about God, make a statement about Him. There's going to be I will say something back, and then you will speak again, and we will keep going back and forth. And consequently, God will never be reduced to some sort of systematic creedal statement. He is transcendent of all those kinds of things. In the Old Testament Bible, here's another example. I've got to stay on topic. But this is a good story. In the Jewish scriptures, the book of Nehemiah and the book of Ruth are often put next to each other. You know why? In the book of Nehemiah, right, the children of Israel have been in captivity. They come back. They're going to do what? They're going to rebuild the temple. But what has happened is that everybody's intermarried with the local tribes, the Moabites, and they rediscover the law, and they hear the law for the first time, and they begin weeping, and they want to recommit to that. And so one of the big themes in the book of Nehemiah is this kind of purging and purification. And so there's this theme, put away your Moabite wives. Let's purify and, purify this nation. Put away your Moabite wives. Let's talk about the book of Ruth. What is that story about? Kind of about a Moabite who kind of gets folded into the kingdom, right? Ends up in the bloodline of Christ. So which is right? Put away your Moabite wives. Incorporate the Moabites. And the answer is, that dialogue keeps going back. And you dance that dialogue in your church, right? Sanctification, purification, holiness. But embracing a wounded world. But if we embrace a wounded world, don't we get all the muck of that world? Yes, and we go back and forth. And is it faith? Is it works? And we see these dialectics all the way in our faith. And ultimately, it's because God is not going to be capturing that formalism. Some of us are uncomfortable with that, because we would like to ground this out in some sort of point. But I don't know if the Bible lets us do that. There's too many different voices. Okay, so normalizing the speech, classroom, one idea is as you prepare, as you talk, think of somebody who suffered. Think of somebody as you speak. You're thinking that person out there in the moment of suffering, that we aren't too quick. So when we pray things like, God, we saw your awesome power in a hurricane. Well, what if somebody die in that hurricane? You got to be careful with too quickly drawing lessons or closure. Now, the next thing I want to give you is kind of a big idea that can be applied in a lot of different ways. What Brueggemann does, and I'm going to have to go real quickly here, and what I've hidden from you is Brueggemann's idea that we go through this orientation, and I am rewriting what I just wrote. We move into disorientation, okay? And then we move into what he calls new orientation. And I think this is a move, okay? This rhythm, he calls it a season of plea versus a season of praise. And I want you to think of those ideas of a season of plea and a season of praise. Because as we know, there's a time for everything. This rhythm of essentially what occurs here is the first move of the Christian faith, which is a move of loss in Christianity associated with the cross and crucifixion. Okay? Move two is one of surprising rescue. So we think of the empty tomb, and so we think of the movement of surprise, loss and surprise. And so new orientation is rescue, and it's a salvation, it's healing. And so there is the Psalms of new orientation, seasons of plea and seasons of praise. This structure, I'm going to ask you to talk about it with your church leaders, your classes, your preacher, because I think it's a nice move to make, and you might not want to do this all the time, but to kind of begin incorporating that sense of loss. Those who come to your worship service is broken. If you start off with, "My God is the mighty God," and you kind of stay there the whole time, they'll feel like nothing, you know. But sometimes we might want to, you know, orient our church to where we are and what we're doing. But there are times maybe in the worship service, and you can begin thinking of songs or scriptures. And we don't have just one scripture reading, maybe two, maybe three, where there is a season, and we might allow the church in worship corporately to say, my God," we see these kinds of things. Show, you know, pictures of a rock or of starvation. And we ask those questions, and we settle there. And if y'all like pyrotechnics, dim the lights at that moment, you know. Before you go, perhaps, into communion, set it up. But then, we don't leave it there, okay? But then we move towards a new orientation, a season of praise, where we call out to God and we know we're going to be heard. And what do we get? What are we going to get when we go to this new orientation? Are we going to get everything righted? I don't know. I hinted, and I want to make sure we have time to read it. Let's go to Psalm 73. If you don't have it, I'm going to read it to you. It's a bit long, and so I might hop ahead. Psalm 73 is a great psalm that starts moving us out of this disorientation, okay? And how does it do it? What can we learn about how we might move people out of the disorientation? And I have a sense it's going to have something to do with my diagram up here. So, all right, Psalm 73, okay? It's going to begin with disorientation, but watch what happens toward the end of this psalm. Truly the Lord is good to the upright, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, now my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant, and I saw the prosperity of the wicked. Like in Psalm 13, right here we see the moral asymmetry, okay? But this person is starting to kind of, you see how they're getting a grip now? How they're prospering. What's wrong, oh God? What is it? Notice that move in verse 3. Kind of start realizing that I was envious of them. And he's going to have to work through that. He's not blaming God. It's an internal statement. Something's going on inside of me that needs to get worked out here. For they have no pain, this is the wicked, and their bodies, they're sound and sleek. They're not in trouble as others are, and they're not plagued like other people. Therefore, pride is their necklace, and violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes swell out with fatness, and their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. And they set their mouths against heaven, and their tongues range over the earth. Therefore, people turn and praise them and find no fault in them. And they say, "How can God know? There's no such thing. There is no knowledge in the Most High. Such are the wicked. Always at ease, they increase in riches. And all in vain, I have kept my heart clean." That interesting? All in vain is the cries. I've kept my heart clean. So here's the Psalm of Lament. For all day long I have been plagued, and I am punished every morning. Now, we're going to start seeing the movement here. And if I had said, "I will walk on this way," I would have been untrue to the circle of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Okay? I'm reading too fast. But when I thought how to understand this, this moral asymmetry, it seemed to me a wearisome task. And here, until I went into the sanctuary of God. And then I perceived their end. Okay? How they are destroyed in a moment, swept up and utterly by terrors. They are like a dream when one awakes. On awakening, you despise their phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in the heart, I was stupid and arrogant. I was like a brute beast towards you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you, and you hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me with honor. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire other than you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and of my portion forever. Indeed, for those who are far from you will perish. You put an end to those who are false to you. But for me, and this is the big moment. It is good to be near God. And I have made the Lord God my refuge to tell of all of your works. You see it sitting here in Psalm 73. Right in those Psalms we ended with last time. You see the disorientation, but it begins this new orientation where I don't know how this is all working out. Every morning I wake up and things aren't working for me, but the psalm ends with, for me it is good to be near God. And they find that in the sanctuary. There's a lot of other psalms that we can point to that kind of fit in here. There are psalms of, and if you're taking notes, you can jot these down. These are psalms that are sung kind of in this new orientation. Like in, let me read the, just give an illustration of this, Psalm 30. Psalm 30, these are psalms of thanksgiving. I will extol you, O Lord. You have drawn me up and did not let my foes rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, I cried to you for help and you have healed me. O Lord, you brought my soul from Sheol, restored me to life from those that had gone down to the pit. And then there's songs of rejoicing. So these psalms of new orientation are these psalms of rescue. I was in the pit, I was lamenting, and you have now righted these kinds of things. There are enthronement psalms, like Psalms 29, where God's rule over all the earth is reaffirmed. There are psalms of confidence in God. There are psalms of praise. Psalms 23, obviously, is a great confidence psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. And Psalms 117 is a great praise psalm. I'm going so fast. Let me back up before we get there. I wanted to add one more thing. During this time of disorientation, I would also like to point out, as you move your church through this and worship, it's not just, my God, you know, why have you forsaken me? But there's also confession psalms. Psalms where the psalmist confesses sin. That is there a moment in church where we pause and in song or in scripture confess sin? Maybe not, you know, to each other, but as a corporate way, reading through one of these psalms. Because, and I can go more into this, one of the reasons there may be moral asymmetry is what? That maybe we're not as righteous as we thought we were. That there is a voice here also. For every song of lament in Scripture, there's also the voice of prophecy. Notice in the Psalms, mostly we're doing all the talking. And when God talks, it's usually through prophecy, and there's an indictment against the people. So sometimes in this disorientation, you also might want to bring the voice of prophecy, where we've lost our way. And that's why the world has got chaotic. It's not really God's fault. Maybe some of it is our fault. So disorientation could add confession and prophecy. Here's my idea, my suggestion for you. Think about your worship from start, you know, to end. And think of, after an initial beginning, moving people through seasons of plea or confession. And here's the idea. Sit there for a while. Okay? Sit there in silence with that. Sit there in song. Sit there in continued reading. But let it sit there for a little bit so that those who want to ask that question about lament, about asking God where He is, that they can let that soak in. That we don't rush our times through that. And this, all that takes is just a little thoughtful worship planning. Just a little sitting down and working through that, finding the right songs, finding the right scripture, and then moving through a season of praise and rescue. And then we start singing songs of deliverance here, and we start praising God again. It might be risky, and the reason why I'm offering this as a strategy is because it might be a little too risky to just devote the entire time to lament. That might be, well, a downer, you know. Interestingly, though, there is a that is diagnostic of something, isn't it? You know, if you think about it, right? Worship is supposed to do what for me? Ah, that's the point. It's little, right? It's not about that, is it? So But still, our people are kind of at a point where if you kind of make them depressed, they're like, what's the point of that? My week stunk, and I came in here and we just lamented. So I don't know if that might be a daring move for a church to do. It might be also a daring move for you to do that as a class. Like that doubt class we had, like I said, we didn't do anything with that. We just got it out. So I'm not saying that you can't just sit, have a season of plea, and the whole time of class or worship is a season of plea. I do think this idea of bringing us out of that to a season of praise, but if we sit there a little bit, can be helpful. Again, when we make this move, one of the things we're affirming is not so much that everything's okay. Okay, notice in that psalm that we had read, what is okay is that we are. It is good to be close to God. It's not that asymmetry has gone away. Notice what happened in that Psalm 73. It's not that things are better now. They are better, but it's because we've reoriented to kind of what this is all about. I kind of had expectations about how this walk was going to go, and I felt I was a good person, things were going to be okay, and it's not, and so therefore I'm kind of sick of this whole religious walk. And faith gets deeper when we commit to this, wanting to just be close to God. And it's the communion part that goes up. Obviously, I've already talked about counseling. That one of the things like that psalm we just talked about, you want to move people from this idea of equity to one of communion. If I was thinking about pastoral counseling, this is kind of where you want to move people. As people suffer and as they are upset and as they struggle with the evil in the world, they're going to be at this issue of equity. It just doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem well aligned. And that's where you begin. You want to begin moving them. You don't want to answer. You don't want to go into like big discussions about the problem of evil, you know, because all of those are fairly unsatisfactory. You know, the minute you say, "Well, most of the evil in the world is due to free will," well, then you have natural disasters. You know, and then you say, well, the reason why we have natural disasters is because the world is a fallen place. After the Garden of Eden, we were promised thorns. And you're like, well, why are the sins of the Father visited on all the children? That doesn't seem to... and on you go. Well, it's Satan. Well, why does God allow this renegade spiritual agent to, you know, to beat up on us? We're much weaker than Satan. Why can't he just kind of put him off on the side and let us struggle when we have enough on us? And on it goes. So you got to answer, but mostly what you're going to do is offer community. But the only way you can offer community is to allow that speech to begin to take place. If I have a take-home point. One other idea. Are we almost out of time? Are we looking at that right? One other idea is to suggest. So I'm offering you this structure for a class. If you're doing a class, this is a structure. For a worship service, this is a structure. And finally, this can also be a structure for your year. I grew up, my mother was Catholic and then converted to the Church of Christ. That's what conversion was when, you know, if you get them switched from Catholic to... but I went to a parochial school. And one of the most profound things that I went through, and most of that was resistant. I was all trying to convert my Catholic friends on the way home because I knew more Bible than they did, you know. And so I just terrorized them with my biblical knowledge, and you know, but one of the things that I walked away with inadvertently and against my wishes was appreciation for the liturgical calendar. Mostly, I just enjoyed it because we were drugged to Mass. And me and a couple Baptist kids, we could just sit there, you know. But we had to go. But we were drugged to Mass. But you eventually get the rhythms of the year the way they do it. And I know in Church of Christ, we feel ambivalent about these kinds of things. But here's what I like about that, is that through a lot of these seasons, there is a season of waiting, of plea, of confession, followed by a season of praise. This happens at Advent. When you are waiting on God. Advent, the whole season, you're just waiting on God. Waiting on the Lord. You know, waiting for God to... And then God comes, you know, in the form of Christ. And so there's this whole season of waiting. We have to teach our people to wait on God. We don't wait on God very well. We want God to show up, and we want to show up now. And sometimes we, and then we also, you know, we don't like the waiting too, because we're supposed to be, you know, further down the road, and wait doesn't have. But what's interesting is that if you kind of follow the Advent calendar, you know, you build waiting in. You learn how to wait. You learn how to anticipate the coming of God. Maybe we will die without God fully coming, like it says in Hebrews. They will long for something they never saw. Their whole life could be spent waiting. Well, do we have the tools for that? And Lent. Every Friday of Lent, you go through the stations of the cross, beginning, the Lord's Supper, the garden, the betrayal, and it's depressing, because every Friday it ends with Jesus died, put in the tomb. Every Friday. Well, that's it. He's dead. And then you go, then you're done. He's dead for like 4 weeks in a row. That's it. And you talk about depressing, so you just got to live with that during that whole season of just crucifixion and death and confession and betrayal of Christ, and I'm indicted in that, and God suffers and dies. But by the time Easter comes, you know, you're ready. You know, you're ready to go. And I do think there's something about, you might experiment your church, but you got to get a little coordinated on this. Sometimes a class can do it. Like, you can't get the whole church to do it, but maybe a class could do a Lenten theme, that on Ash Wednesday you talk about suffering and confession and betrayal of Christ, and, you know, building up to a season of praise. Again, you're using it as a tool. You're not saying that Jesus was born on a given day or whatever, but mostly you're building in seasons of plea into the entire year. Just another way of kind of allowing the winter Christians to feel comfortable, because in Lent they'll be really happy. You know, because everybody's depressed along with them. Hey, I know we're off time, so thank you for coming. I appreciate it. I'm honored that you came.